Thank you for giving up your afternoon, and welcome to the theater. People are gonna keep coming in, but we'll keep going. I know that it's exam time and there's pressure on everybody. I know some people here are going to be here because it helps with their course and module on corporate social responsibility. I guess you'll get people with the laptops and the pens. Everybody else, you're here to learn something, I guess, and to be intellectually challenged and to see perspectives around how business and the economy and society can interact with each other. As your chancellor, it gives me immense pleasure to welcome Right Honourable Sir John Redwood, MP, as our guest lecturer this afternoon. His lecture is gonna be on the sustainable economy growth and public-private partnerships, or something around that area. Now, John graduated from Magdalen College in Oxford and is a distinguished fellow of the All Souls in Oxford, which is the top academic community, I think. So we're in august company. He's a businessman by background and has set up an investment management business and has been an executive and a non-executive chairman of an industrial public company. But I think we all will recognize it's his political contribution that he is most well known for. In the 1970s, John was a Oxfordshire County Councillor. In the 1980s, he was Chief Policy Advisor to Mrs. Thatcher, and he was first elected to Parliament for Wokingham in 1987, and was made a minister within 2 years by the Thatcher government, part of the Thatcher government. In the 1990s, he served in John Major's cabinet as the Secretary of State for Wales and stood twice for the Conservative Party leadership and has constantly campaigned and advocated for free markets and for us to keep the pound. After the 1997 general election, John served in the shadow cabinet in various briefs and as chairman of the opposition's economic policy review and has been chairman of the Conservative Economic Affairs Committee since 2010. Outside of Parliament, John is a visiting professor at Middlesex University's Business School and has authored many books, each focused, I think, on one or more of the economy, politics, or the European Union. So he's clearly got tremendous experience in both business and politics. And I think he very much owns his recognisable personal brand as well. I describe it as refreshingly direct, authentic, punchy, and intellectually robust. But all of which is thought-provoking for us all, and no better place than a lecture to release some of that brand power. So I'm sure the next hour will bring plenty for us to think about. So as an entrepreneur, I very much look forward to hearing John's thoughts in this lecture. You know, my experience of building a business from a crazy idea through to market leadership was all built on that very core of how can you create prosperity and economic growth and social impact. And it's given me a certain perspective, and I look forward to listening and learning from John's perspective and the conversation that we have afterwards. Now, impressively, John writes a daily blog, johnredwarddiary.com, and yesterday's, I think, was a punchy rebuttal of the nationalisation of the railway companies. So our challenge today, I think, is to make John's time with us as thought-provoking and as interesting enough for him to think about writing and blogging some of what we discuss this afternoon. So in welcoming John to the podium, we're going to thank him for 36 years of service to Wokingham. Many of our colleagues, past and present, will have be residents and voters in his constituency. 36 years and counting. Thank you for supporting the university and our community, and we offer a very warm welcome to John Redwood, MP.
Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor, faculty, students, thank you for that very warm and accurate welcome. You don't always get either the warmth or the accuracy in my job, so it's a great pleasure to follow that. And it is a privilege to be here sharing a platform with your Chancellor, because he is showing how you can be successful businessmen, you can create jobs, you can create wealth, you can do good things for the community, you can serve people better, and then you can translate that into the academic world and into the world of public service. And it's that combination that I think can add so much. And when you have someone of talent, it's good that they share it more generally, and that sometimes they're using their talent to make profit. Nothing wrong with that. It drives the world and creates more success, but sometimes you share it for free because you are a nice person as he is, and you wish to make sure those conversations are informed from different perspectives. I always found when leading big industrial businesses that there was so much sense in what is now called ESG. I always started by looking at my staff and wanting to create something that worked for them. Because if you could align the aims of the business with the personal aims and ambitions of the people in the business, they would work better for you and they would find it a more pleasurable experience. And I always used to stress to all the staff that they, like me, had only one purpose in life in the business, and that was to serve the customers better and well. And that if we didn't serve the customers well, the money would dry up, the turnover would decline, the losses would mount, and we would be in great trouble. And I always used to say as well that we lived in a community or communities, and we needed to be good neighbours. And things would go much more smoothly if you not only carried your workforce with you, but the people who had to live near your factory or had to look out on your activities. And so it obviously made sense to handle waste well, to control noise, to consult before you extended your factory or whatever it is you wanted to do. And that was my common sense way of trying to approach these challenges, particularly acute when I took on the chairmanship of a struggling small international industrial business, which had an important factory in Birmingham, had factories in India and the United States of America. And when I first went to the British factory, I could almost have cried. It was a loss-making business. It had upset a lot of its customers. The product wasn't good enough. The service wasn't good enough. The staff were very unhappy. And the factory was a mess. And it was, how do you sort it out? Because there is no money. Because when you've made a business into that kind of condition, nothing's going to work, and you haven't got the cash because you haven't generated the turnover or the profit in order to turn it round. So one had to start with some very basic things, courtesy to the staff, listening to what the staff wanted, listening to the staff's complaints, and then explaining to the staff the constraints we were under and that it would get better, but we first had to serve the customers better, we second had to get some more revenue, then we could start spending a bit of money. In the meantime, you could sort the factory out with a broom and a brush and a cloth, and you could mend the obvious problems and try and make things a bit better. I remember setting up an early version of a green project task force, it would be called now, I guess. But it was also a money-saving idea, because this factory was a mess. And I remember saying to them, I only have to come to this factory once or twice a month. It's not a very pleasant experience. I'm very glad I don't have to work here every day. I really don't think you should be working in this. So give me an idea of how we rehandle the waste, how we recycle the waste, how we clean the factory up. And one of the ways we saved money was that it had glass panels on a corrugated roof on this very large factory. And they were so dirty, you had to have the lights on all the time to see what you were doing at machines, even when it was bright and sunny outside. So paying a little bit for a cleaning contractor to clean the windows up, and then we could turn the lights off half the time because God was providing the light free, and everybody felt better. It was nice to have a bit of sunlight around rather than having to have artificial light. So green could be clean, which could be more economical. I remember chief executive, very talented man I was working with, who did most of the work, obviously. He was a bit suspicious of this chairman wanting to lead some kind of green project in the middle of this very difficult recovery when he was battling every day to get the right quality to persuade the customers. So he gave me just a little team of junior people. And then he was delighted when we came back and I got them to talk to the board. And they said, well, we think this will save $250,000 a year. Suddenly his eyes lit up. Because it could make sense. So I'm a great believer in doing things well by the customers, by the neighbours and by the staff, and then getting that alignment. And I've always felt it's better to employ fewer people, pay them better and align their interests rather than going for mass recruitment and then finding you've bought yourself trouble and they're not always willing passengers on the journey. So looking out at the audience, and particularly the students, I mean, who in this audience wants in due course to be working for a company? There are some of you. And who wants to set up their own business and do what your chancellor? Wonderful. That's what I like to see in here. I wish somebody had suggested that to me when I was your age, the student age. It took me a little while to realize that that was the thing to do, and I did it rather later in life. And it is a great privilege to run your own business. It's also extremely hard work. The joy is you're free to make big decisions. You're free to decide when you work, how you work, what you offer. The bad news is the buck stops with you on everything. And there are no days off because you are fully committed. And if your customers say jump, you jump. And you merely ask them how high and then try and jump a bit higher than they've asked. And it's only when you get into that big business shape that you have a little bit more countervailing bargaining power. Well, big topic today that you've set me is sustainable growth. And my guess is you've done an awful lot on the sustainable side, so I thought I'd do a little bit more on the growth side, because I think the advanced world faces a major problem over the next couple of years, because we're going to have no growth, little growth, or even moving backwards. And we need to ask ourselves, why should that be, and what can be done about it? And I'm afraid it's the result of lamentably bad central banking by the Federal Reserve Board, by the Bank of England, and by the European Central Bank. We are told, although I don't believe this, that these central banks are independent of government. And we are told that they have to be independent of government because then they make wise judgments. Whereas were those dreadful politicians to interfere with the central banks, they would make foolish judgments and we might end up with an inflation. So I invite you to look at the evidence, because if you take the five most important central banks of the world, the three renegades I've mentioned in the West, and the Bank of Japan, and the People's Bank of China, what do we see? Well, we see in the case of the People's Bank of China that they proudly say that they follow the wishes and the words and the policies of their president, President Xi. And they couch everything from their Monetary Policy Committee in language around this is what the Central Committee of the Communist Party wanted, and this is the policy laid down by the guiding party, and this is how we are implementing the wishes of the government. So how did they do during the Great Inflation? 2% was their inflation throughout the Great Inflation in the West. Now this is very curious, isn't it? Because our independent central bank, so-called, told us that they didn't do anything wrong. We ended up with 10% inflation in the United Kingdom and in much of the European Union, and almost 10% in the United States of America. But they said, oh, well, no, that was because of Putin and the invasion of Ukraine. So don't blame us. Well, then why was it that inflation was 2% in China? Because they are the world's biggest importer of energy, I think, and they certainly had to pay world prices or prices related to world prices for the imported energy they needed, and yet their inflation stayed at 2%. So then let's look at the Bank of Japan, a democracy, and has some idea of being closer to the American-British model of independence. But again, if you look at what the Bank of Japan says and does, it very clearly and expressly operates within the tram lines of government policy, and it works extremely closely with the Japanese Treasury as well. It might. And what do we see there? Well, we see core inflation still under 2% throughout the COVID period. It's true that headline inflation rose mainly because of imported energy, but it only got to 4%. And nobody thinks it's going to stay there. Nobody thinks they've got a problem that they need to deal with. Indeed, the Bank of Japan is still setting an interest rate at zero for 10-year money. And wouldn't it be lovely if you or I could go and borrow 10-year money for zero interest? But the state of Japan has been able to do this for many, many years now. It's not all good news. Why are they able to do that? Well, it's because they had the most awful boom and bust as long ago as the 1980s. And they've never really recovered from it. Their banking system remains very constrained and damaged by those events. And so the state can keep borrowing at 0%. The central bank can create money to buy bonds to keep the interest rates at 0%, and they don't get an inflation as a result because it's not lent on. Whereas what happened in the West, the mistake the central banks obviously made, was that having, quite understandably, printed a lot of money and kept interest rates around zero during the lockdown period as some kind of counterbalance to this extraordinary distortion, this very damaging economic policy which the West decided to follow, maybe for good health reasons. That was a necessary offset, but come 2021, the economies were recovering well, the lockdowns were over or partially suspended, things were happening, and yet the Federal Reserve Board, the Bank of England and the European Central Bank decided to carry on printing huge amount of money, buying up a lot of bonds, keeping interest rates around zero, and told us that wouldn't be inflationary. Further point in the case that I think you have to challenge central banks is the Bank of England sitting with its extraordinary justification that it was all Putin's fault, had to report 5.5% inflation, almost three times target, the month before the invasion started, the month before the energy prices surged. So I rest my case. So what do we need to get growth? Well, actually, what we need now is the Western central banks to avoid the opposite damage, and that is they are lurching from far too loose, with money far too cheap and far too plentiful, to the danger of money being too dear and too tight. And you will not get sustainable growth if you have very volatile interest rates. It doesn't help sustainable growth if you have very volatile inflation. And we are now seeing the Americans in particular deliberately driving their economy into a what they hope will be a shallow recession, so they keep tightening the screw. And instead of, for example, just holding the bonds that they bought up in huge quantities and waiting for them to roll off as and when they mature, both the Federal Reserve Board and the Bank of England have decided on massive bond sales to drive the price of bonds even lower on the market and drive interest rates even higher. And it was, of course, that policy by the Bank of England, announced on the eve of the famous Truss-Kwarteng mini-budget, which took the gilt market right down, undermined the LDI funds and the pension investors, and created a really nasty situation in the gilt market. Eventually, the bank woke up, and it reversed it, and it could reverse it just like that. All it had to do was announced that it wasn't going to be selling bonds, it was going to buy some bonds, and the market flipped as you'd expect it to do, because it's a market very dominated now by government issuance and by Bank of England ownership. And if you got to the point where the pension funds didn't want to buy the bonds because the bank was telling them they were going to smash the price of them, you then obviously had a collapse. And then in America, the pressures came out from this very foolish policy in the form of stresses in the regional banks. And so the most obvious one where my connection is very clear is in Silicon Valley Bank, which is now a blessed memory. And Silicon Valley Bank was cash rich. It was the banker to many of the successful tech companies. It had lots of deposit money because the tech companies were generating cash. And some of that deposit money was the money they needed to pay next month's wages. And some of it was the winnings on profitable business, which they didn't want to deploy or weren't able to deploy immediately. The bank put that into what they thought were safe investments, American Treasury investments. The Federal Reserve Board sold treasuries badly in order to drive the price down. The bank lost a lot of money on the treasuries. That was becoming quite obvious to their depositors. Their depositors say, we don't want to be in a bank that's losing lots of money on treasuries. So the depositors start walking to the exit. See, they don't even have to walk anymore because they've got these wonderful mobile devices which can shift their money at the press of a little button. And so we had a run on Silicon Valley Bank, and you know the rest. So these are very destabilizing policies. And if they go on like that, the growth bit of sustainable growth in America, Britain, Europe is going to be extremely difficult to deliver. And please, one day, may these central banks start to get it right. Can they try and get the porridge not too hot and not too cold, but actually at the right temperature to eat? We've had it far too hot for too long. Now we're getting it too cold. Please, banks, sort it out. The other bit of background, which is very important to world growth, a theme which is not helpful to growth, is the move to deglobalization. We lived through a couple of decades when globalization ruled okay, and when successive rounds of trade liberalization came more to fruition, when there was a move not merely to integrate trade in goods, but an attempt at last to try and create more flexibility and integration of trade and services. And China was welcomed in by the West. China emerging from poverty and from extreme communist dirigism. And China was beginning to liberalize her domestic economy and allowing some free enterprise to take the strain and offer some growth. And so the West very generously allowed China into the World Trade Organization and allowed China free access to our markets without expecting free and fair access to the Chinese market at the same time. The idea was that progressively as China got richer, the barriers to our entry into China would come down. But unfortunately, that's all over. As we know, it started with Trump. Trump called China out because he thought they were trade cheats. He thought they were undervaluing their currency for a very successful economy, and he thought they were stealing or forcing the purchase of American technology in a way that he didn't like. And interestingly enough, that was about the only thing Biden agreed with him over. And when Biden took over, he continued the policy of challenging China over the terms of trade and the basis of trade. And we're living through this retreat from globalization, the creation of two major blocks, an American-led bloc and a Chinese-led bloc. Chinese-led bloc has got much more control over Russia as a result of the dreadful invasion of Ukraine, and the West wish to strip Russia out of many of our supply chains, particularly for energy. And so we have to live with this, and I'm sure you're going to be hearing more from the G7 summit this weekend of the leaders. They are working out more sanctions, more restrictions, more bans. And certainly in the era of technology, there's the wish really to stop trade in technology, and obviously no trade in weapons or anything like that. But it will spread over to other areas, and so it is a constraint on growth. In the few minutes that remain before I open up, find out what you really want to hear about, I will mention my two main themes for how you analyze and describe this world. And these are themes I've been running with for some years now. They predate COVID, but they were paradoxically both intensified by the COVID experience. And those are the digital revolution and the green revolution. And you are here studying the green revolution intently. I hope you're studying the digital revolution as well, because it's the one that's going faster with more business opportunities than the green revolution. And these are very different revolutions. And I think the green revolution has to learn from the digital revolution for its exponents to be successful. Because the fundamental difference is that the green revolution is a top-down revolution. It's a revolution willed by the governments, willed by the large corporations, willed by the international experts. But it hasn't taken off with the public. If you poll the public, they say, oh, yes, serious problem, we need to do something about it. But if you poll them, you're going to buy a heat pump? No, of course not. If you poll them, would you buy an electric car? Well, probably not, and certainly not at these prices. And if you poll them about, will they stop eating meat? No, of course not. We like our beef burgers. There is no popular buy-in to many of the salient requirements of the Green Revolution. And until there is, it's not going to work very well. And it is causing all sorts of havoc in the market economy. Because governments are very powerful and they get very frustrated that the public isn't doing what they want. Why won't the public go out there and buy an electric car like I have, says a government minister? Well, they can't afford one and they don't like them, otherwise it's a great idea. Or why hasn't the public given up eating meat? Well, I bet you haven't given up eating meat at the G7. I dare say there's plenty of that on the table when you go to something like that. And then there's shouts of hypocrisy. So there needs to be a buy-in. So my challenge to all you budding entrepreneurs or people who want to join the large companies of this world is, who is going to design the Mini of the electric car revolution? You know, that iconic car of the 1960s that made motoring affordable for British people on low incomes and revolutionized how people thought of a car. Or the Golf, more modern image, the Golf of the revolution, the Volkswagen Golf, which tickled the fancy of people in many countries and was a relatively good value small car that people really loved. We haven't yet found the Mini or the Golf. The Tesla is a rich man or woman's toy and often owned by somebody who's got a diesel out the back for when they want to do a long journey. So it's not really the thing that is going to provide the impetus. And who is going to design the heat pump or the hydrogen gas boiler system that will mean that most of my constituents, who assure me they're very green, are sitting at home on a cold day relying entirely on their gas boiler, as I do, because it's cheaper, better, we're used to it, it's technology we know about, and we're not ready to buy the heat pump. It's dear, it's disruptive, and some people who bought them haven't been terribly happy with the results. So the green revolution needs to find the popular touch, and these huge billions and trillions of capital, much of it subsidized, some of it brought out of taxpayers' hands and put into business by government, is flaying around trying to find the products, the services, the industries, the investments that might pull this off, but they've got to get the common touch. And then there's the digital revolution, which is the bottom-up people's revolution. Yes, there are great companies and rich people who are leading it, but they don't have to force people to buy these things. Government didn't tell me to buy a smartphone, didn't tell you to get a laptop or a pad. You did it because you liked the service it offered, or you did it because it gave you the capability to do things you wanted to do. You wanted to download online entertainment. You wanted to do your learning from a distance. You wanted to keep in touch with your friends. You wanted to communicate in the social media world. All these things meant that people, often very modest means, put a significant sum of money for them into a smartphone or a pad or a laptop or whatever for themselves and their children and their parents and grandparents, because it was a necessary part of modern living as they saw it. And the problem there for governments is the other way around. This is all happening and governments are saying, oh my God, we didn't ask you to do that. We don't know what you were doing. Is it safe? Are you going to get the better of us by having this? We don't control you. And of course, it is technology which governments can play back at you and turn it into ferocious control. I don't think I want to live in China with all the surveillance that is probably going on through the smartphone and through the cameras everywhere. I'm told that a Chinese person can walk down the street past a shop and the phone might ping and say, you like buying so-and-so, well, they're 20% off today in the shop you're just passing. Well, that might be a nice offer, but you could do other things with that technology as well, which you can dream about as well as I can, stuff of which nightmares are made. So at the G7, we hear a late comer to the ball is, what do we do about artificial intelligence? Suddenly it's on everybody's agenda. It's just a development of computing power that's been there for many years. Suddenly captured the media headlines because of ChatGPT being an offer which can revolutionize the way students do their work. A nice challenge for those teaching them. So we have this problem of, what is AI? What does it do? What might it do? Where is it going to go? And we, the governments, are we controlling it? I suspect a lot of what could go wrong, could happen on AI, is already illegal. Because it's already illegal to treat people badly and slang people off and libel them. It's already illegal to go onto the dark web and run criminal businesses and that kind of thing. General laws may well take care of a lot of it. But it won't stop governments from looking at it and trying, and so they will be desperately trying to catch up with something which is very much a people's revolution. So, sustainable growth, how do you do it? Very simple. Make goods and services that people like and want to buy. And you can either do things they already know about, cheaper, better, faster, or you can do things they don't know about, which they say, yeah, I really want that, I love it, it's really great. And that is where the two revolutions of our age are challenged. If the green revolution kicked in with the popular products on top of the digital revolution, we get really good sustainable growth. It would be a really exciting ride. But at the moment, there's a struggle, there's a tussle, and quite a lot of the clunky interventions in the market by governments in the name of greenery are counterproductive and deeply damaging. I'll finish with one example. Many of my colleagues in Parliament think it would be quite evil of the United Kingdom to open up a new gas field or two in the North Sea, because that, after all, is fossil fuel. And I argue the contrary, because I say our refusal to open up those new gas fields doesn't mean that you and I drop our gas boiler and plug into renewable energy for an electric heating system. It means that we import the gas, and that gas comes in as LNG from America or from North Africa, and that generates far more CO2 for the world than if you had gas down a pipe from the North Sea. Indeed, I managed to get a figure out of the Department for Energy and Net Zero the other day. They're not very good at giving out figures, particularly ones they don't like, but they had to agree that there'd be at least twice as much CO2 generated for the world if I go home this afternoon and turn my gas boiler on and I'm firing it with LNG from America than if I was firing it with natural gas from the North Sea. So I think it's crazy environmentally, and the economics are dreadful, because it means our country is saddled with an enormous import bill, a huge amount of taxes paid away to the country that sent you the gas. We lose the tax revenue, we lose the highly paid jobs, and we lose the development potential of cheaper energy. So I rest my case, and I'm ready to be told I'm completely wrong by all of you.
Thank you very much indeed. A whole range of opinions, views, questions for all of us within that. Particularly the last topic, I think, played a lot to what students have been doing over this last term. So I'm going to open this up for a few questions on any of those topics. So does anyone like to kick off with a question? Good.
Why do you think there's that lack of connection between the digital and the green revolution?
So why do you think there's a lack of connection between the digital and the green revolutions?
Well, because of my theme, that I think the one is popular and doesn't need government to drive it. If anything, government's trying to restrain it. And the other is not yet popular with most people. And I'm just suggesting, all those of you who are wishing this well, and I'm sure you do, you've got to make it more popular with people with limited means who are trying to lead normal lives. And at the moment, they need the petrol car to get the kids to school and to get themselves to work. And they need the gas boiler to keep themselves warm. And they're on a normal diet. And they're not ready for the heat pump and the electric car, even if they could afford it.
Now, I ask a follow-up to that. How does government make it more popular? Does the government have a role in making it more popular, or is that something which is left to private industry?
I think it's very difficult for government to do anything but harm in that situation. The interventions are usually clumsy and may often have the reverse consequence in the way I was describing, as I see the gas intervention. What can government do? And we didn't do much on partnerships, did we? So I better do something on partnerships. I think it's very difficult partnering with a government if you're a company, particularly if you're a small company, because it's the elephant and the mouse kind of problem, and it's very easy to get trampled on inadvertently, even if they didn't mean to do it, and sometimes they do mean to do it. So I think that the best relationship a business can have with the government is a customer-supplier relationship. And so what can the government do? It can actually buy things that it wants, and that may pump prime other people liking them. It may get you to scale more quickly, which might help with the cost structure or the perfecting of the device. And yes, of course, government can pump prime at an earlier stage. So government is a lead investor in new technologies. It can sprinkle some money on it, but I don't want the government being the sole one or doing it too much, because we have a perfectly good market mechanism for pump priming and investing and seed corning ideas in small businesses. And Britain in recent years has got a lot better at having a market infrastructure to do that. America is great at it. And so there are these pools of capital in the private sector that can be mobilized, whereas government's been pretty bad at backing winners in the past. And it can just lead to losses and higher taxes, which doesn't really help the whole task. So I think number one is be an informed, sensible buyer. Number two is to work with the science establishment, with the universities, with the venture capitalists and private equity houses on funding things that make sense. I mean, one that's going on at the moment, which I've been asked to write about and its wider implications this weekend, is hydrogen. And some people think that instead of trying to get people to take on electric heat pumps in their homes, it would be much easier to get green hydrogen, hydrogen generated by using renewable electricity to crack water, pumped through the pipes to their gas boilers. And many of our modern gas boilers could take hydrogen, or we wouldn't need much of a tweak, apparently, to take hydrogen. And so the government is seed corn funding a whole village which is going to be invited to have a free conversion and a period of 2 years experiment to see, does it work well? Have they controlled all the obvious problems? Trust it's fully safety authenticated before the trial goes ahead, as it must be. And then if that works, they might want to start scaling it up. Well, and that's a perfectly useful thing for a government to do that's very, very keen on all these things. But is that the right allocation of money? And would the market make the same conclusion? Well, maybe not, because maybe hydrogen is more applicable to trucks and heavy plant. Because there's a general agreement, I think, that heavy trucks and heavy plant can't really run on batteries. First of all, the battery is far too big and far too heavy, so you get an awful lot of the power wasted on moving the battery around. And if you've got more stationary plant, heavy plant, you need it to work all the time because these are very expensive bits of kit. You can't afford downtime for recharging. And so JCB has done a lot of work on this. They developed some electric products, decided that they weren't good enough, and they went straight over to a hydrogen product, and they've now got a hydrogen direct drive replacing the diesel direct drive. So maybe you put more of your money into that. And I think venture capitalist markets are probably better at making those kind of calls than the government is. I mean, previous governments intervened a lot in the last wave or two waves ago of computerization, and the government saw that somebody was going to pull it all together. But the government-sponsored companies, I think, ended up bust, whereas the Americans seem to work it out through the private sector, and they've now got four $4 trillion companies on the back of it.
Thank you. Another question. John, first of all, thank you for your talk. It certainly stimulates John's brains at this point. I am experiencing to follow on this. Now, the Americans have, with the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, have put a huge amount of investment behind the green and the green economy. It looks like the EU is following suit. What do you think the UK's
response should be? Well, we've got to match them, but in a different way. I mean, my recommendations to the government are based around tax reductions. I think we're taxing our energy system to death, and that is going to be a very big drag on us attracting these kind of investments.